Heather Henninger is back on the show, continuing our four-part conversation about suicide prevention and awareness. Today, I'm going to talk with Heather about the definition of what anxiety and what depression are, the ways that we find ourselves into these depressive and anxious states, and how we can utilize our own personal practices and the breath that we have within our bodies to help get us out of these states. Heather has a beautiful, vast knowledge working with NLP, neuro-linguistic programming, as well as Kundalini yoga, and has a very amazing approach to helping with anxiety and depression. I'm very thankful for her time and for her wisdom in sharing with us today. Hope you get something out of the conversation. We'll see you on the other side. But first, a message from our sponsor. Our healing journey can be difficult and might feel lonely at times. That's why I love sound baths. When we can get together in a community, we intrinsically support and feel supported by others. And that combined energy can help us go deeper into our own healing journeys. And all you have to do is just lay there for 1 hour and listen to beautiful healing sounds. I'm a sound healing practitioner, and I hold sound baths on a regular basis in the greater Seattle area. You can find my next sound baths on my website at adamrealhealing.com. That's Adam, A-D-A-M, real, R-I-E-H-L, healing, H-E-A-L-I-N-G.com. AdamRealHealing.com. Your healing is worth your time. And now an uninterrupted episode with Heather Henninger. Hey, welcome back to our show. Today I have a returning friend on, Miss Heather Henninger. Heather was on, actually just a couple months ago, she was on episode number 63. We were talking about her neuro-linguistic programming and Kundalini yoga. And so Heather is just a vast cornucopia of knowledge. I've enjoyed our conversations both on air and off air over the past few months. And so what Heather has combined her knowledge base into right now is a psychodynamic somatic therapist. She runs a holistic center called Swan Lake Holistics down in Tulum, and is just an amazing resource for what we're talking about today, as well as neuro-linguistic programming or Kundalini yoga. Vast knowledge here. So if you have any questions about any stuff we're talking about, you could look back to our previous episode, or you know, we'll leave contact info in the notes for everything. So, but continuing our conversation, we're in our four-part conversation about suicide prevention and awareness. Heather actually was the person that kind of spurred this whole idea to do a four-part episode. After our conversation, the last episode we recorded, off-air, we kind of talked about this, and Heather had brought that up, and it made me do some soul-searching and understand how much suicide has impacted my life, not in a very direct way as far as people around me committing suicide, which has happened here and there, but not anything that I would consider dramatic, but more so gave me an idea of the mirror inside of myself to look at me and say, I've had these thoughts quite a bit throughout my life. Thankfully, I've never acted on them, but there are definitely thoughts that have entered into my brain in very, sometimes very depressing anxiety moments, sometimes very happy moments. I have these thoughts that come through. And so, you know, through these conversations that we've had these first two episodes, we talk about how normalizing these type of conversations can help us take the stigma away from sometimes these random thoughts pop into our heads. And if we can have the vulnerability and the comfort to talk about them, then we can find ways to conquer these issues that we're working through. And so that's one of the things that Heather and I want to talk about today, is identifying some of the ways that we can help each other and help ourselves out of these depressive, anxious moments and out of these suicidal thoughts and back into our constitution of humanity and community that we thrive in. So Heather, you're amazing. Thank you so much for being back. I really appreciate you.
Thank you so much for doing this, Adam. It's such an important topic, and it being Suicide Prevention Month, and I really honor you for creating the platform for us to speak about it in an open way, because part of the reason why it continues to be prevalent is the shame of speaking about it. So thank you.
Yeah, my pleasure. So in the previous two episodes, we've talked about and identified a lot of what the suicidal tendencies can be and the ways that we get into our suicidal kind of thought process and patterns. And so today we wanted to take some time to kind of talk about how we can get ourselves back into a place that we're, you know, raising our energy level, raising our vibration level, introducing some type of happiness meditation or some kind of understanding of personal peace. And there's, you know, and that's what I love about this conversation. There's so many ways that we've now figured out how to either up or down regulate our nervous system through breath work, through meditation, through all these different types of tools But the unfortunate reality is that right now we're still having to search out these things. They're not readily taught to people on a regular basis. It's not me that has this idea, but I love the idea and I share the emphasis and enthusiasm behind it about wanting to try to find a way to introduce this curriculum into like a schooling or some kind of like, you know, regularity to every child is learned how to get themselves out of an anxiety attack, how to get themselves out of a depressive state, how to get themselves out of a panic attack, you know, all these things that we find ourselves in because of the world that we live in. We're naturally pushed into these areas of non-competency, if you will, to where we're not in our constitution, we're not in a place where we want to be. You know, like up in Washington right now, we're unfortunately pretty much up and down the West Coast, we have what's called fire season now. You know, and that used to, now it's one of our seasonalities. You know, there's forest fires, the smoke comes over, and we're in the Kirkland, Seattle area. And so basically this haze comes over and you know, I'm not trying to say that the haze is worse than the fire, right? Than the people that are experiencing the fire. But now we have this haze that comes over pretty much the entire West Coast for weeks, if not, you know, a month at a time. And one of the things that I've realized in my research that I do is that fire, the threat of smoke, the threat of that idea causes fight or flight. And it has for centuries and centuries and centuries in humanity, you know, because we're afraid of fire. We're afraid of forest fires. We're afraid of smoke. Smoke is destructive. Smoke is, you know, these things that can take out entire populations. And now we have an entire season that's revolved around fire and the threat of smoke, the threat of fire. And so we're constantly being put into these fight or flight modes, whether we realize it or not. You know, we could be the calmest we can be, but all of a sudden now our genes are programmed to see smoke and get panicked. Be like, oh my God, there's shit happening. Right. So even if we're not consciously aware of it, our subconscious is still noodling on this in the background. So there's all these different things that put us into these stressors throughout society that, you know, once we become aware of them and we become aware of like how we deal with them and the stories that we tell about them, then we can start to pull ourselves out of these areas. Right. So one of the topics we want to talk about today is breath work. And breath work is one of my favorite things to practice personally. I'm not a licensed practitioner. I do hold breath ceremonies and certain with certain clients that I have. But by no means am I a licensed practitioner like my friend Camo or maybe yourself. But there are beautiful ways that we can work with our breath to up and down regular system. So would you like to start off with that and maybe talk about some of the ways that you've found that's helped?
Yeah, of course. I mean, the interesting thing about breath, you know, you talk about being certified, but it's something that really, I think being certified in breath work or pranayama or something like that really is just about studying the science behind it more than anything else. So if I think anyone who understands the regulation aspect of it is qualified to teach somebody else who's having issues with it.
Yeah.
Because, well, let's just talk about the first thing is that it's yoga sees it as two different things. First and foremost, it's our literal breath, right? It's the respiration of the physical body that happens through the circulatory system or through the respiratory system, excuse me. So it's the breath itself. So that is the gross aspect of the dense, you know, I don't know if you could say technically that it's tangible, but we feel it in our body. That sense of taking a deep breath is tangible for us, right? That's not necessarily something we can see or feel, except for the expansion of our chest cavity. Mm-hmm. But it is the literal breath itself. So it is gross and dense, but it is also the subtle chi, if you will, the QI as spelled in the English form of through Chinese medicine, mm-hmm. or the Kundalini itself. So that part is subtle, but the breath itself, the gross dense part, carries the subtlety of the life force energy that we all have inside of ourselves. So therefore, breath is both subtle and gross and dense at the same time. Does that make sense?
It does. Yeah. I love that.
It's also the other kind of irony to it is that it's both automatic. So it is literally part of our autonomic nervous system. Breathing is not something that we have to think about when we're busy driving or working or taking care of our children or what have you. it's not like we have to consciously say to our nervous system, okay, take a breath. Okay, take a breath. Right? It's happening automatically until we're triggered, right? And then that's when we hold the breath, but sometimes we don't even realize that we're doing it because, like you were mentioning, we've been shocked or triggered or scared, or suddenly we're anxious and now we're holding the breath and we're constricting the blood flow to, you know, our extremities. Mm-hmm. But my point is, it's automatic, and it's also the only part of our autonomic nervous system that we can voluntarily control.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know that.
So we can't voluntarily say, okay, and think really hard, lower my body temperature, you know, and like suddenly your body temperature is decreasing because you're hot or you have a fever. Mm-hmm. Or you can't suddenly, you know, consciously say to your digestive system, okay, digest that, you know, loaf of bread I just had because it's feeling really heavy in my belly.
Right.
No, the body will just, it'll deal with it when it can. However, the breath we can control, but it's the only part of our autonomic nervous system that we can control. And when we do, we can positively affect the other aspects of the automated parts. Like, we can actually lower our body temperature with our breath. So there's like a famous pranayama within yoga called Shiddhili pranayama, which is otherwise known as tongue taco breath, or taco breath, where you curl your tongue and you sip air in through your mouth and then exhale through your nose. And it has been scientifically proven to decrease body temperature. And it's also a application to apply when you're hot-headed or angry. It will help bring those emotions back down. So it's known as a cooling or calming breath.
That was one of the first breaths that I learned when I first started taking yoga. We learned Ujjayi breath, which is that engaged inhale and exhale through the nose. And then the first five that I remember learning was that taco cooling breath. And it blew my mind. It at that time, like, I was still very unaware of how the body actually keeps the score and how the body works and how all these things that the body can do. And the first time I curled my tongue and breathed in, it felt like this peppermint rush just like entered into my body. It was so intense and crazy. And that was the first time that I really realized that we do have that control. We do have that ability with our breath to figure things out.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, there's a laundry list of all the effects that our breath can have on us, but I'll just mention a few. Mm-hmm. When we're able to master the breath and learn different techniques to control it, everything from segmented breath to ratio, you know, playing with the ratios of breath, you know, and the different techniques like we just mentioned, like Shiddhili pranayama or Ujjayi breath, they all have different types of effects. But when we master the breath, we can promote our own vitality. So we can bring more energy to the body if we're tired. We can also calm the body down if we're feeling anxious or if we have insomnia, for instance. It moves our emotions. So it helps us process and move our emotions. So it's, you know, when somebody's really upset and they're talking 100 miles a minute and, and they're, you know, in their story and they're really upset, that we say, hey, calm down. Hey, take a deep breath. Right. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So it's like, we do actually know these things. We have, you know, adages and common statements that we make in our vernacular that to some of these greater wisdoms, but we just forget. It also helps control our moods, like I just mentioned. It helps us also, different pranayama techniques can help us increase our concentration and have more focus, which can directly affect the brain function and the hemispheres of the brain, so that the two hemispheres are operating more in alignment with one another. So we're equally creative and discerning, or, you know. And then another one that I like to mention is that it promotes connectedness. So if you've ever been in a Kundalini class or any kind of yoga class, really, where the teacher is emphasizing that the room that the students breathe together, you can feel that there is, you know, an energy field that is created by the group. So we say in Kundalini Yoga, when you walk into the classroom, everybody is coming in with a different frequency. Everyone's vibrating at a different, energy level. Mm-hmm. But by the end of class, we've created this sort of group union, and now we're more in unison with one another, and it's like a collective, elevated group environment of energy that is, it's perceived and it's felt. It's pretty incredible.
Yeah, when I start my sound baths, you know, and yoga, you know, yoga is pretty, at least where we teach up here in the Northwest, it's very breath oriented. I know there's some yoga that doesn't follow the breath with movement, but, you know, up here we do. So it's pretty standard to like unify breath, get in child's pose, take a few breaths together. And it is palpable. Like you can really feel things coming together, like the unified breath of the whole group coming together instead of all these individuals that come in. And, when I do my sound baths, I always go through like a heart coherence breath, you know, a 4-count inhale, 4-count exhale to really get all of those people together, you know, because especially when we go into a sound bath, for my experience with that, there's a lot of intentional healing that goes on with that, you know, and so everybody comes in with their own individual intentions, usually something around healing. So when we can draw it all together with the breath, it almost amplifies everybody's healing intention by getting together and saying, hey, we're all doing this together. We're all in this together today. We're gonna help each other out through our breath, through our unification, and we're gonna get through this shit, you know.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
That's absolutely beautiful. I also think it's worth mentioning that, like, in a couple environment, it can breed a lot of connection. I mean, that's part of the science behind Tantra. Mm. Tantra gets misinterpreted and only thought of as some sort of sexual experience, but it's so much more than that.
Right.
But that's kind of also, you know, in a really intimate, you know, way as well. It doesn't always have to be in a group fashion. Mothers can also do this with their children. Mm. You know, if the child is really upset, it's also just a way. It can be, again, either conscious or not. You know, if you're actually in the couple and one of the people is, experiencing some sort of, you know, aggravation or something like that, we can create easy rapport by just taking a deep breath and mimicking a little bit of like the other person's body language, and they'll start to mirror ours. Mm-hmm. When we're consciously breathing, and it can also help support that person in kind of calming down.
Yeah.
I
see that a lot with my, with clients, when I'm working with Reiki clients and energy clients. People will come in, their breath will be a little erratic, or their pulse may be a little erratic, and, you know, we'll get them on the table, take a few breaths and try to calm that down. But one of the things that one of the ways that I was taught to hold space for these ceremonies is, you know, I breathe very, very deeply and intently through these ceremonies. There's some whistling things that I do involved, but there's always this very conscious breath. And what I can notice is that about maybe 5 to 10 minutes into my session, my client's breathing starts to match my breath. And we can start to feel that big inhales and exhales together, because I'm doing them very audibly and not with the intention of, hey, match my breath, but like as almost an example, like, hey, this is your space and opportunity to take some very deep intentional breaths. Find a sensation in your body and leave it at the word sensation. Don't try to identify it as good or bad, because if we say good, we'll be sad if it's not there next time. If we say bad, mm-hmm. then we already create a story around why it's bad. We just mm-hmm. see a sensation. We identify it as a sensation. We send some breath to it. And when those deep, engaged inhales and exhales, and they're very purposeful and meaningful, there's a lot that can be released and activated, or, you know, whatever you need, whatever your intention is, through that focus and through that breath. That technique was taught to me in Vipassana meditation, you know, the body scan technique, where you sit for, the first 10-day silent meditation retreat I did was the most intense experience of my entire life. And I've done many plant medicines, but sitting in silence for 11 hours a day for 10 days straight is, wow, man, you can't run from your shit. You got nothing to go. You got nowhere to go. You can't watch TV. You can't read books. We couldn't do yoga at the time. All you do is walk, meditate, eat, and sleep. And goddamn, if you don't find some things that you need to work on in your life. But that breath was...
I've been wanting to go to Vipassana for years, and for years I was scared of it. And then at the end of last year, I thought, okay, I'm finally ready. I'm finally ready, but I haven't gone yet. So, that's... I understand how that could be so challenging.
But it's
I can sit for, 62 minutes in the most painful, uncomfortable, mudra or posture in a Kundalini meditation, but doing that, not thinking, not speaking, not chanting a mantra,
Yeah. It's very intense.
Whole other level.
Oh yeah. But our breath and anxiety and depression, one of the things that I love about breath work with this is it really helps us to get ourselves into a place where we can identify either in the state that we're in, anxiety or depression. There are so many different things that we can do with our body to help us get that rest and relax state. And we have to realize that a lot of our world right now puts us in a fight or flight state, right? And it's just, from the traffic that we sit in to, the amount of understaffed, like say you're at work. I mean, there's such an understaffing of employees right now. Say you work at a restaurant, your normal table's five table section. Restaurant staff is the hardest staff to staff right now. And then you have people taking 20 table sections, which is anxiety. Like I have nightmares about that shit. That's my server dream nightmare, is going in and having everybody called off and I'm the only person there to take all the orders and make sure all the food and drinks get out. Like that is so anxiety ridden to me. That's, I can honestly say that's one of my excuses for drinking as long as I did, was putting up with that kind of shit. Right. And if we're in that constant fight or flight, even when we start to relax and we start to wind down, our body still feels that anxiety. And if we're going to sleep in that anxious state, then and that rest and relax is typically when our body has the opportunity to repair, right? Go into recovery, repair. I figuratively like to think of like this little person that comes out into my liver and starts to, with this little broom, and starts sweeping out the corners of my liver and getting all the cobwebs out, doing all the things, all the maintenance it needs to do to all my organs, all the parts of my body, because I'm rested and I'm relaxed. But if I'm constantly in fight or flight, then I'm honestly thinking that I'm being chased by a saber-toothed tiger at every second of my day. And so my body doesn't have time to sweep out the cobwebs. It doesn't have time to do the rest and repair. And so that's where dis-ease starts to sink in a very, very quick way, because we're basically inflamed in our entire body, and disease loves inflammation. So it'll find these little pockets, dig in, and then create all this chaos inside of us. It goes from anxiety and depression to a disease that, could be something more than what we can handle within ourselves. But if we can get to a point where we can identify and work with things like breath or other techniques, we can get in front of a lot of this shit and not have to get to that extremities.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what you're speaking to is that there's a literal chemical cocktail that's being created in the body throughout every cell in the body. And when you're speaking of the experience of the stress response and the ongoing, Deepak Chopra has a whole entire book about it and talks a lot about it, but you're right. It's like when that chemical cocktail has been created, it's hard to just, once you're at home, after your serving position is over with and it's time to wind down, the body can't just turn it off like a switch, right? Those chemicals are literally still running through your bloodstream. And like you said, you speak to a very important point about the inflammation, because it is that very point that you're making that then creates the greater diseases, the physical diseases. So it's actually stress. I mean, doctors will, point to the fact that most diseases are created by ongoing stress.
Yeah. So with breath work, what are some of the breath techniques that maybe two or three that you found that have been very helpful for you, whether in Kundalini practice or in your NLP practice?
Well, they're different, but for anxiety versus depression, mm-hmm. but the simple most, the practice that I teach to beginners, that because it's just absolutely so simple, it's hard to forget, is just a 1-to-2 ratio breath. So you inhale and you count the length of your inhale. So let's say it's 4 seconds, then you double the length of your exhale. So it's 1-to-2 ratio. So if your breath is, 6 seconds, then you would try to make your exhale 12. And it might take a few, rounds of inhale, exhale for you to find that, exact ratio. And you may not ever find it exactly, but the point is you're trying, you're aiming for that 1-to-2 ratio breath. Mm-hmm. And what that does is it triggers the heart rate variability and it starts to calm the vagus nerve. And it has a direct effect on what we call vagal nerve tone. Mm. So we kind of mentioned this in the last episode that we were together, where vagal tone is directly correlated with heart rate variability, which is simply, as a brief like overview, every time we inhale, our heart rate slightly speeds up. Mm-hmm. And every time we exhale, it slightly slows down. And this can only really be measured by a machine at a hospital. But all you need to know, all the listeners need to know, is the more that you elongate your exhale, you're slowing your heart rate down. And that's it. Having a direct response, positive response on your nervous system's response to stress. Mm. And it creates what we call vagal nerve tone. So just like you tone your muscles, you can tone your nerves. And the more that you have, the greater vagal nerve tone you have, the more you can respond to stress better.
Mm. Wow. I do remember us talking about that. And I think the example you gave was singing and chanting at that time.
Exactly.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's beautiful. So, I've been thinking a lot about that since that conversation.
Yeah. So when we hum or sing or chant mantra, we're naturally doing that. It might not be 1-to-2 ratio breath. It might even be 1-to-5 uh-huh. when you're chanting a mantra or something. But that's even better because you're increasing at an even more exaggerated rate the heart rate variability in a positive way. Hmm. So that's the simplest breath that I can teach anybody that I really love to do.
Yeah. That's it's interesting you say that, because that's the breath I usually go to for when I'm teaching somebody to lower their depression or to kind of like get him back into their body. For the past couple of years, I've worked with a high school cross country team locally and teaching them yoga, teaching them stuff like that. But, you know, as I've gotten to know them and worked with them more, the coach has given me more leniency to like teach them meditation techniques and teach them breath work and things like that. And so this year I'm working with them. And the two types of breath work I'm teaching them is at the very beginning, I'm teaching them the ratio box breath, you know, so it's a mm-hmm. 4-count inhale, 4-count hold, 4-count exhale, 4-count hold, basically creating a box. And then for that activation, for that focus, right? Because, you know, that's a beautiful breath to get back into your focus. And the way I sell it to them is like, if you have a test you're getting ready for, you're getting ready for your track meet, you're getting yelled at by your parents, right? You have all these things that raise our anxiety level. This will help you get back to a focused place that you can respond in kind and be proud of the way that you respond instead of let your anxiety kind of take care of you. And then that the ratio breathing with the double exhale, that's, you know, that's what I usually end with them and teach them like, hey, this is, you know, you've just got done with your test, just got done with your meet, just got done with whatever crazy shit that you had applied to 10 colleges, didn't get into any of them, whatever it is, right? Here's how you get back into your body, you know, double your exhale. And then I think the one thing that we didn't mention yet is that typically when you inhale through the nose, we trigger calming sensations in our body. Mm-hmm. And if we inhale through the mouth on a regular basis, that's kind of like panting, and that can send us into fight or flight.
Exactly. I mean, we do in Kundalini yoga have some pranayama techniques that incorporate mouth breathing, mm-hmm. but by and large, we're always, the default is to breathe through the nose for that very reason. When we do breathe through the mouth in Kundalini, we recommend, like we spoke about before, whistling or making like puckering your lips as though you had a straw in your mouth, where you're measuring the breath and you're not, it's like a, it's controlled instead of the experience of when you're shocked or scared and you would,
right.
It's more controlled.
And that puts like a consciousness to it, right? Because it's not a reflex. It's like, okay, no, I'm pulling this breath in with intention through my mouth, through my taco tongue, if you will. And then I'm going to push it back out, you know, but there's that intentionality behind it. It's not the reflex of like, oh my God, like what just happened?
It's two things. It is the intentionality behind it. Absolutely. And also when you pucker your lips or you curl your mouth so that you're creating that taco with the tongue, you're also stimulating nerve endings that are in your mouth that run up into your brain. Mm. Or whistling does the same, right? Because you're right? You've got these taut lips.
Yeah.
And that also directly affects the brain. So it's both things that are happening.
Wow. Yeah. Very cool. There's one other thing you mentioned before we move forward, and I just find this funny because it's so true to me, at least. But humans forget. Humans are forgetful. Like, we might know all the things that can help us out. We've done all the classes. We've taken breath. We've done all the things, meditation, all that shit. But when those moments of stress and anxiety come, how can you draw into that? Because that, you know, in the very beginning, even though I knew all this stuff, like, I would still find myself depressed, still find myself anxious, because I didn't remember that I needed to take a deep breath. I didn't remember that I could sit down and meditate. And so, I mean, not the only reason, but I literally got "remember" tattooed on my knuckles. Not just because of that, but there's many multitude of remedies, reasons for that. But one of the things is like, I can just now look down at my hands and see the word "remember" and be like, oh, that's right. You know, I am a strong human being. I am in charge of my constitution. I am the person that can get myself out of depression, out of anxiety. There's this big, strong remembrance. And I think that's part of our conditioning. I think that's part of our experience as a human is, you know, we're taught all these things that we might know, but if they're not really, if we're not dialed into it, we'll forget them really quickly. And especially when we get to moments of intense emotion, whether it's depression or anxiety, our brain goes sideways, right? If you're in pain for 3 days straight, you haven't gotten sleep, and you sprinkle a little bit of alcohol on top of that, you're psychotic. You're a psychotic human being now. And that could be the most put together or, you know, derelict person that you can think of, right? It doesn't take a lot for us to go sideways. So it's not hard to think that it's not hard for us to remember. Like, we forget that shit because we get into places where we're not proper in our constitution. So that's why I have "remember" tattooed on my fingers. Not recommending for everybody to get that, but you know, just give yourself grace. We forget, but we can always remember. We can always get back to that place.
Well, I agree with you. And I also think that that's why I like to encourage everybody to consider themselves a teacher, because if something's worked for you, it can work for somebody else. And this is kind of like goes back to what I was saying at the beginning of the show, where you said, I'm not a certified breathwork teacher, but you know so much. You know so much more than the average person who's suffering out there. And as long as like what the little few things that you are teaching to people, you know, are like scientifically backed or whatever,
right,
teach them to more people. And so if there's a listener on here that has the knowledge of three different, you know, pranayama techniques that can support somebody else, teach your mother, teach your child, you know, teach your best friend.
Right.
I mean, if we could just teach people how to remember how to breathe again, the world would be a better place.
Such a big step. Most definitely. I appreciate you bringing up the certification thing. And I've joked about this in the past, and you know, I'm not discarding certifications and, you know, people that take the courses and all that stuff. But I also do believe that in a lot of the realm that we live in, right, in the energetic realm and things like that, breath work, meditation, things like that, I don't really feel that we all need to be certified to an nth degree or to really any degree at certain points, right? One of the jokes I used to make, and I won't tangent about this too much, but one of the jokes I used to make is like, think about prehistoric times. You have caveman Ankh and caveman Zonk sitting around a fire, right? And they just got done being chased by a dinosaur. And Ankh is fine, but Zonk's freaking out. And Ankh just turned to Zonk and said, hey, take a deep breath, right? He takes a deep breath and he's fine. Ankh is a breathwork practitioner from the prehistoric ages, has no certification. Zonk is now, you know, healed, right? So we have these abilities within us. And if you have the passion and the desire to chase these down, that's great. Utilize the information that you have, do it in a responsible way. But the fact of like always chasing down certifications and always spending this money on all these different types of things just so we can get these alphabets after our name, if you're that passionate enough that you want to find that depth in it, that's great. But there's also ways that you can do this without having to spend a shit ton of money on all these certifications that, to be completely frank, I could certify you in sound healing, but who certified me? Nobody. Right? I just know sound healing from experiencing it myself. Does that give me the accreditation to go ahead and open up a school and certify somebody else? Maybe somebody will hold accreditation for that. Maybe somebody will hold some weight to that, but maybe they won't. Right? So to echo what you're saying is, if you feel that strongly about it and you feel safe in the way that you're delivering that message, get out there and do something with it, you know?
Well, I mean, I agree with you in terms of course, there's legitimacy that gets had when you do have a certification and you have studied, and I have over 1,000 accredited hours, but, you know, I still think there's a lot of people that know a hell of a lot more than I do, but I know that I've helped a lot of people.
Right.
And I guess my point is, if there's like a third grade teacher who's listening and she knows that 1-2 ratio breath or singing or humming or chanting mantra helps increase heart rate variability, and she teaches this to her students as a way of conflict resolution in the classroom, or, you know, that it can work, you know, and it can have a profound effect on those children's lives as they grow up. It's something that's so simple that they can take with them as, you know, as they grow into adults.
Most definitely. Most definitely. And I really hope that more teachers are utilizing that kind of information out there.
Yeah.
So we've talked about anxiety and depression busters, and I'm really kind of excited to talk about this one. And basically it's like how to address your nervous system, right? So now you've identify that you're anxious or depressed. And so what are some ways besides breath work, which you talked you know, very in depth about, what are some other ways that we can kind of get ourselves out of these states?
Yeah. Well, we've kind of been mentioning depression and anxiety interchangeably because they're so prevalent right now. But for one moment, I just want to, if it's okay with you, just quickly address like what is anxiety and what is depression so that it's clear.
Yes, please.
Is that cool?
Yeah, please.
Okay. So we all have felt sad or depressed, and we all have felt anxious, right, at some point in our lives. The thing that, you know, by DSM-5 psychology standards makes it depression or an anxiety disorder is largely about the severity and the length of time the symptoms are being felt by the person. Okay, so a depressive episode is when a person experiences a depressed mood, like feeling sad or irritable. Irritability comes a lot with depression, or emptiness, or, this is key, a loss of pleasure or interest in activities for most of the day, nearly every day, for at least 2 weeks.
Wow, okay.
And that ranges from everything from, you know, there's a laundry list of, you know, well, you live in Seattle, so you understand the seasonal affective disorder that can happen
most
for
definitely.
People at a seasonal level. I used to live in Bellevue, so I know what that feels like to go almost 2 months without ever seeing the actual sun break from the clouds.
Uh-huh.
But it also includes major depression. It can include postpartum, right? There's a whole laundry list of these. But it affects people in ways like poor concentration. As I mentioned, like reduced interest in their former activities that they used to love. Insomnia or sleeping too much, weight changes, fatigue, all sorts of things. So I personally suffered from depression for 15 years, and I can say that the irritability was a huge thing for me. I would fly off the handle and just like scream at a coworker or my mother or somebody. Or, I mean, there's a very close group of friends of mine from my 20s who I have consistently apologized to for having put up with that phase of my life. And it can also come with excessive guilt. So that's depression. And then anxiety, it's the same in that it's about the severity, it's the length of time. So the American Psychological Association describes a person with anxiety disorder as having recurring intrusive thoughts or concerns. That's kind of the quote. And then once anxiety reaches a stage of disorder, it can interfere with daily function. So that's the big one, is that, like, is it interfering with your daily life?
Right.
Are you not able to drive your car? Are you not able to, you know, meet your responsibilities, your deadlines at work, your responsibilities at home? Is it affecting your sex life? Like these sorts of things.
Okay.
And it includes everything from agoraphobia, which is very severe, where you know the person doesn't leave their house, social anxiety disorder, panic disorder, or there's something that I think a lot of people are struggling from right now, which is generalized anxiety disorder. It includes things like restlessness, sweating, sleep problems, panic attacks, phobias, and uncontrollable feelings of worry.
Okay. All right.
So as it relates to the nervous system, there's kind of two different approaches. For depression, it's more about increasing. I remember this. Remember when at the top of today's episode, when I was speaking about the breath both being dense and subtle mm-hmm. at the same time. So remember, the subtle part is the life force energy in the body, right? And we call it Kundalini. We call it Chi. Here, where I live in Tulum, the ancient Mayas called it Chulel, right? There's lots of different traditions that speak of it different ways or call it something different, but we're speaking about the same thing and we're all accessing some of it. Otherwise we wouldn't be awake and alive and doing things, but we have a storage center of it that resides below our belly button. So the yogis talk about this, Chinese medicine talks about this. Mm-hmm. And the key in for treating depression, according to yoga, is to increase energy through prana, breath and life force energy. So increase respiration and also activate more of your life force energy rather than from adrenaline. So increase energy through prana rather than from adrenaline.
Okay.
So therapies that, you know, are ones that Kundalini yoga does these like repetitive movements over set periods of time where you're pairing breath with movement and you're doing the same repetitive action, like the same back and forth posture. It's not really a posture. It's more of a movement mm-hmm. for like 3 minutes, 7 minutes, 22 minutes, because you're creating this rhythmic flow. And it has a restoration of the nervous system and your endocrine system. Your endocrine system is your hormones, mm-hmm. right? And what it does is it, over time, it releases stored stress from the body.
All right. So these, you know, and you mentioned specific times, 3, 7, 22. And I remember from our previous conversation, there's very specifics for certain things that you guys do. So that was, 3 minutes, 7 minutes, 22 minutes. Okay.
thanks for pointing that out. Otherwise people are like, those are random numbers.
Yeah.
They're actually usually for meditations, but also for our postures. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Is there a significance with that length of time with Kundalini? I can't remember if we talked about that last time.
It's 3 minutes. The general ones are 3 minutes, 11 minutes, 22 minutes, 31, 62, and 2.5 hours.
Okay.
And so there's different effects that happen. I don't know if I know, I don't know if I can remember all of them off the top of my head, but after just 3 minutes of meditation, the concentration of your blood changes from being more acidic to more alkaline. At 11 minutes, I can't remember what happens at 11 minutes. At 22 minutes, we speak of having three minds, the negative mind, positive, and neutral or meditative mind. And at 22 minutes is when those three minds merge together. I think we spoke about this on last episode, which is why 20 minutes, like a lot of traditions will speak about meditating for 20 to 22 minutes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
When you get into the even longer states, the auric field is shifted and changed. Your aura becomes stronger. And then at like 62 minutes and 2.5 hours, the gray matter of your brain can actually change.
I've heard that. And I've heard that constant meditation, with what they've put, some long-term meditators into MRI machines or MFRIs have seen that activation of the gray matter in their brain and their frontal lobes and things like that.
Yeah.
That's just I love watching that. I love learning and nerding out about like the science of meditation and things like that. Now we can test it, you know, not that I needed it in the beginning, but just like, I love that we can see, you know, what it's actually doing for us now.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. The master of Kundalini, he said, you know, I'm explaining all of these things, but it still could take another 200 to 500 years before science catches up.
That's, I love that. That's great.
So he's like, just do it. Just like, take my word for it.
Yeah. When you reincarnate a couple times down the road, then we'll have the scientific information. For now, just do it. Trust me. You'll be fine. Yeah. So, okay. So moving our bodies in some kind of rhythmic way, linking breath with movement.
Linking breath with movement so that you're increasing that prana through those methods rather than from adrenaline.
Hmm. And because adrenaline is that's when we get spiked, right? That's when we get like fear or something like that. That raises our energy level, but in a very chemically induced kind of way.
That's the chemical cocktail we were talking about. Yeah.
Gotcha. Yeah.
It's one of the ingredients, let's say, in that chemical cocktail. Yeah. Yeah. There's several different stress hormones, and that's one of them.
Okay. Yeah. And I think, you know, for me, I can't say that I was ever depressed for a long, like I've had depression, right? I've been depressed. I've definitely have bouts of that lowness but long-term depression, I don't think is something that I've experienced unless I'm just, you know, not being honest with myself. But I can honestly say that when I started taking yoga and started doing yoga, my whole energy level, my whole body, my whole constitution as a human being shifted, and I could feel this uplift of my energy. And at the time that I started doing yoga, I was very heavy. I was like 240 pounds, which right now I'm 170, so for my height, like I'm should be around there, so I was overweight for where I should be. And so, you know, a lot of that weight leaving and the energy moving in, I could feel the rise of my vibration. And now, you know, like having being in this industry and in this life for about 12 years, seeing all the things that go into that and now putting some context as to why I felt better. And it's, you know, a lot of that is that body movement that you were talking about, linking breath. But the thing that I don't think I realized until maybe just a couple of years ago was how important the community vibe is, and having the community around you and being in that moment of you're in a room with, you know, maybe two people, maybe 20 people, right? And afterwards, you're all giving it your whatever you got, right? But then afterwards, there's this vulnerability that just kind of shines through. And we forget that we're being vulnerable because we're so just energetically open that I could sit next to some random person and have the deepest conversation that I never expected to have and feel that love and embrace from a total stranger. And that's like everything my body ever wanted that I never knew I needed.
Yep. You speak to a really important point. In fact, today I follow Mastin Kipp on Instagram.
Okay.
And I saw a post of his that said, trauma is healed through safe relationships.
Mm. Wow.
And there's a cardiologist, a doctor. I'm blanking on his name. Dr. Dean Ornish.
Okay.
he did all of this research to prove that heart disease is reversible.
Oh.
And when he wrote a book and he went and, you know, presented to all of his colleagues, there's four elements. I'm going off topic for a second, but I'm bringing it for full circle.
All good.
Just bear with me. He said there's four elements to curing heart disease or reversing heart disease. He said low fat for these particular groups of people, right, who have a propensity for it. It's eating a low fat diet, getting regular cardiovascular exercise at least 30 minutes. I think it's between 3 to 5 days a week. I'm forgetting the third one. And the fourth one was having group support, knowing that you have a family, knowing that you have doctors you can count on, knowing that you have a yoga community. It didn't matter like who the group was, whether it was familial, blood related or whatever, but just having group support and knowing that you could, you know, lean on somebody.
Wow.
And all these doctors went and they said, well, but which one is the most important? And he said, no, 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 you don't understand. It's like it's a program. Like it's all four of these things together. And at their persistence, they asked him, please go back and tell us what is the most important. So he did something like 6 more years of research.
Okay.
And guess what the most important thing was?
Community.
Group support.
Community, group support. Wow. That makes a lot of sense. You know, I mean, we're.
Oh, the fourth one was meditation. Having a mindfulness sort of, not meditation, but any sort of mindfulness practice. Anything that where they could come back to their breath. Mm-hmm. So you could, you know, I think especially as a yoga, that's kind of ironic that that's the one I forgot.
Yeah.
I would almost, if someone were to ask me like out of the blue, which one would I think would be the most important for heart disease? I think I would have said that one.
Mm.
But so I was quite shocked to know, and this is scientifically proven.
Right. And that isolation thing is huge because, you know, we just came out of isolation. We just came out of COVID,
exactly.
Mandatory isolation, which I know you have that on topic list here in a moment, but that put us all into this anxiety, depressed state, right? We don't know what's happening. We're depressed because of the, you know, we don't know what's going to happen. All the things that we're missing out on, we're anxious about the things we don't know about. And isolation, you know, humans have been, you know, group tribes since we kind of figured out what humans are, right? We've always been around other humans. And all the technology that we're creating now to make our lives easier is separating us. And even though, yes, I can get on my phone and I can, you know, I can IG somebody in China right now and talk to them, or I could, you know, ping somebody in Afghanistan and talk to them, which seems connectivity, but is that real connection that we have? Is that the real support that we have? And we're finding that that's not, you know, we need that human to human connection in some kind of way. There's a Dr. Zach Bush that I love to follow. And he mentioned something the other day that I was listening to. And he said, you know, metaphorically, you can say the first diagnosis of cancer happened when the first person put a fence up around their house,
mm-hmm.
right? Because isolation, right? We said, this is mine. You can't have this. This is mine. And cancer is when the cells stop communicating with each other and they think they're alone. So it's like, shit, now it's all on me. I'm the only cell left. I have to create all the things. And that's where tumors start to spread. You know, and so we created that idea of separatism for the first time we put a fence around something and said, nope, this is mine. You can't be on my property. Right. And now we've just continued that. We've continued it. We've continued it. And there's been so much separation. You know, there's, you know, I can say down in Texas where I grew up, and it's a little different where you grew up. I felt, you know, I have a very nostalgic reminiscence of my home. But down in the South, there's that Southern hospitality where you don't have to know the person to start a conversation with them. I could be pumping my gas and all of a sudden 3 people walk by and ask me how my day's going. And they honestly and earnestly mean it. You know, they'll sit there and let me answer them, you know, but I come up here into the Northwest and I can't make eye contact with somebody to save my goddamn life. You know, it's just everybody's looking at their phones or their feet and things like this, you know, and that's, you know, that's locale, you know, difference. And not to say people in the Northwest aren't nice. It's just there's a difference of that, right? And so having that separation and that divide that we continuously kind of dial into, a lot of the technology we're creating is completing that divide. How do we get back to those community-based relationships? You know, and even things like yoga, you know, when we were in COVID, like great for YouTube and Zoom and all that shit that we could do yoga. And it was great to see like the Brady Bunch screen of all the faces and, you know, we could, you know, have some community that way. But still, that wasn't community, you know, that scratched an itch for a little while. But is that the solution for community at that point in time? You know, did that drive us deeper into the separation of like, shit, is this what I'm stuck with now? Do I have to get used to the Brady Bunch screen and that's where my community comes from? Why can't I just go say hi to my neighbor?
Yeah. And I mean, I think there was a lot of fear that was instilled too of, well, you know, something being contagious. And so like, well, people weren't even seeing their closest family members.
Right. Yeah.
I haven't seen my 96-year-old grandmother in like 3 years.
Oof.
So actually the family is making a whole trip up for Thanksgiving because finally everybody's comfortable with
yeah.
it.
Mm-hmm.
Look, my grandmother's 96 years old and she's more or less spent the last 2 to 3 years of her life mostly alone.
Wow. Wow. And that's, especially in those older years, you know, we need to feel the support, you know, and in a lot of different cultures, when you reach that certain age of retirement or where you need care, you move back in with the family. You mm-hmm. don't get put into a home. You don't get put into mm-hmm. some other place where you pay people to take care of. It's like, no, your grandma, grandpa, uncle, whatever it is, you're coming to live with me and my family. We'll take care of you. And in turn, it's not like, you know, this it's an expected thing, but in turn, you are imparted with all of that wisdom and knowledge that that human being has gained for right. their entire life. And then that's spread out through your family. So then now you have those familial stories, you have that generational stuff that gets passed down. And that's, you know, that's the extension of community through family. Right. You know, we're still learning. We're still embracing. We're still accepting. We're not just like, you go over there. We'll visit you when we can, you know. And that's, a lot of what the West is like. We've kind of gotten into that mentality of we don't want to have that around as we don't want to see death and decay. We don't want to see it on the way out.
Yeah. It's unfortunate. I think we're finally coming out of at least the COVID effects of that. What you're speaking to about the elderly. And I mean, it's, can be a discussion that's very cultural because, you know, I live in Mexico mm-hmm. and they're very family oriented yeah. and it's and in a lot of Asian cultures as well, it's actually the grandparents that largely raise the kids because the parents are working,
right?
You know? And so it's a cultural thing, I think, for a lot of Americans
yeah.
in particular. But in terms of like how COVID and technology in general separated us or divided us in many ways, whether it was about belief systems or, you know, whether people were getting vaxxed or not getting vaxxed, it created a lot. And if I could just share a couple statistics, I mean, it's pretty crazy yeah. what occurred in that. So, first of all, the World Health Organization, whether you trust them anymore or not, they have for years claimed that depression is the most common disability worldwide wow. in people under the age of 60.
Wow.
So approximately 3.5% of the world's population suffer from depression. But among adults in the United States, it's always historically been higher, in higher averages than the world averages. So before COVID-19, depression levels in the US were around 9%. They rose to 28% in 2020.
Shit.
And this is in the US.
Wow.
And then this year, they rose to 33%. Wow. So basically one in every three Americans is suffering from depression right now. And the thing is, what's sad is that there's so much stigma around it or a misunderstanding about what the person is feeling that they don't even realize that they're depressed.
Right.
They just feel like they've been feeling sad or irritable for an extended period of time. So there's a lack of awareness around it. And for that reason, a lot of people don't seek help because they're just trying to manage it on their own, thinking they're just going through a tough phase of their life.
Right. Yeah.
And now anxiety is even actually also, I mean, the numbers are similar. Mm-hmm. About 4% of the world's population suffers from anxiety. This class, though, of mental afflictions is the most common mental illness in the US.
Wow.
And pre-pandemic, it was around 18% of the population, and less than 40% of those people are seeking treatment. Hmm. I don't have figures for what currently the rate is now, but I do know that worldwide, anxiety increased to 26% of people worldwide. So that went from 4 to 26% worldwide.
Holy shit.
And it was always higher in the United States. Yeah. So it's, you know, I don't have the current figure on that, but I mean, it's incredible. Yeah. I call it the not so silent pandemic. I think the mental, our mental health is the pandemic.
Wow.
The state of our mental health is the real pandemic.
Yeah. That's those numbers are atrocious. That's crazy. And it's almost, in a way that's, it's like this, what we called the pandemic just now, the COVID pandemic, is maybe shining light on what the true pandemic is, what you're talking about, that's not so silent pandemic. Like we needed the world to slow down in some kind of way. And I do believe in like higher powers and things outside of myself and all that stuff. I try to stay away from conspiracy theories because anything can be a conspiracy theory now. But, in a way I maybe there's like this, we're all part of this cosmic plan. We have no idea what's going on. Right. But there's this thing that had to take the entire world by storm, had to grip the entire planet. It's not just a continent. It's not just a part of the world. It's the entire planet experienced this COVID situation that we're dealing with now. And that's the overarching, that's like the main kind of like, the main evil thing that we're looking at. Right. But we're not seeing the thing that's actually fueling what COVID is, and that's the anxiety and depression. And we get that thing out of the way, and then we can see what the true thing that we're really battling is that it's our internal shit. It's not an external force that's coming in and trying to destroy us. It's our own selves. It's our own creation that we have within ourselves, the depression, the anxiety, the not dealing with our stories, the not understanding of how we actually show up as human beings, that's driving us into this separation, into these states that are unfortunately leading to some suicidal attempts and suicidal thoughts. So I when you brought up that not so silent pandemic, that just like hit me like a ton of bricks.
Yeah. I mean, I think the more that we can, educate people that first of all, they're not alone. There's lots of other people pretending not to suffer.
Right.
And we can begin to educate people and take the stigma away from seeking treatment, and do it in a way that is, I mean, my preference would be in a holistic and natural way, but I do understand too that there are times when prescription drugs are maybe needed, especially if suicidal ideation is happening. Mm-hmm. I want to be clear that in the 15 years I suffered from depression, I never took prescription drugs. Mm. Because I knew, I studied psychology as an undergraduate, and I knew of the laundry list of side effects that can come with them. Mm. And I just didn't want to play around with my brain chemistry. But I'm not saying that that's, not okay for other people. I'm just not a resource for speaking about my experience with it, because I never had any experience with the prescription drugs. But there's so many other things that you're carrying with you all the time, like your own lungs, that you can, with practice and dedication, you can shift your state of being.
Right.
So that's kind of what I'm a huge advocate for. And it goes to without saying that another person who talks a lot about his depression and has done a lot to shift, I've had dinner with him. He's an interesting character. Is Wim Hof.
Ah, yes.
And cold water treatment. And in fact, we have a ritual inside Kundalini Yoga that is an ancient ritual of taking a cold shower in the morning before you do your morning practice, because of the effects that it has on the physical body. And if you want more research related to this, I'm not an expert in this particular field, but Wim Hof has actually taken, I think now at least four things to actual research labs. And I think they're available on his website. He's very, passionate about sharing about cold water therapy. But I do know that it's the one thing that can actually clear your capillaries or cleanse and purify your capillaries, which are the smallest, teeniest, tiniest blood vessels in your body. Hmm. And it has some sort of effect on your endocrine system.
Yeah.
I'm not the most eloquent at explaining this part for about cold water therapy, but that is also a really, really effective treatment for depression.
Wow. I didn't know that was for, that was a good treatment for depression. My girlfriend got me into what's called sfitzing, a couple of years ago. And,
what's that?
So we have Russian bathhouses up here in Washington. And, so
I'm jealous.
Oh, it's so great. I love it. It's the best.
Well, I have Temescals.
But yeah. Yeah. You're into Tulum. You probably got a lot more cool shit than I do. so sfitzing is the idea of hot and cold. Like raising your body temperature and then crashing it down and then raising it and crashing it down and kind of going between those two states and helping your nervous system, helping your circulatory system. It's really great for joint pains, things like that, because you're basically just, you're flooding your body with all different kinds of hormones and endorphins at different points in time. And, you know, for me, that cold water therapy has been just a huge, huge impact in my life in a very beautiful way. And I've tried, I've tried cold showers because I've friends that are Kundalini teachers and Kundalini yogis and preach the cold showers and God, it is the hardest thing for me to do just to psych myself up and to get to like wake up in the morning and then take a cold ass shower.
You start slowly. So if anyone wants to try it, you start slowly, turn the cold water on and you just stick your feet in. Hmm. And then you kind of like rub your feet, you know, maybe like you're rubbing the bottom of your foot on the top of the opposite foot. Mm-hmm. And then you kind of use your ankles or whatever to rub together. And then you slowly, slowly work your way up. You don't submerge your head.
Oh. Okay.
And Wim Hof doesn't either. Mm. So you don't submerge your head. And it also can be really effective if you're on the brink of getting sick. It can trigger your immune system. Mm. But you rub your body briskly in the cold water. So there's always like some sort of movement happening. Okay. Because you're starting to like activate the blood circulation. And I do know, I said I wasn't an expert in cold water therapy, but I guess I do know some things, but I'm not an expert. But it creates gland secretions. And when your glands start to secrete in a different manner, then you change your blood chemistry. Hmm. And when your blood chemistry changes, you literally change your blood. And the blood is the composition, the yogis say, it's the composition of your personality. Hmm. So whatever's showing up in your blood, like for instance, a quick example, if you have low iodine, there's a propensity for a person to be impatient. Hmm. So when you do when you take these cold showers, you're changing the endocrine system and the function of the glands, which then affect blood, which then affect the heart and the kidneys, right? So there's a lot that happens.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't realize there was that much going on for the cold shower. I thought it was more of, I don't know what actually I thought it was. I'm just kind of terrified of it. Oh, man.
Try it tomorrow and shoot me a text and let me know how it goes.
I'm going to, because I've never tried to rub my feet and things like that, like increase circulation. And I've always just like dove right in because I'm like, just get it over with. And I put my head and my face in and my hair and I'm like, I'm fucking cold now.
Yeah. Go slowly and rub, you know, and it's also really good to lift your arm up and let the cold water run under your armpit. Mm. This is great for women. It's preventative for breast cancer. You can like massage your armpits, which sounds weird to do, but our nervous systems come together. Our different nervous systems come together underneath at our armpits.
Hmm. Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
Very cool. All right. So, take your cold water, take your cold showers.
Yeah. If you're depressed, go to a Wim Hof workshop.
God, and that guy, I mean, just in general, that guy will raise your vibration. He is such an energetic.
Oh my God, he's amazing.
I've never met him, but I've seen him. I've heard tons of interviews. I've watched his YouTube channels. I've done a lot of his practices. And I always just leave so joyed just by his personal joy. He's just such a happy human being.
He is. He's, like I said, I had dinner with him. I was at Summit Series in Los Angeles and he was like, get in here. And yeah. He was like, gave me this big bear hug. And I was like, okay. Like you can't say no to him. He's just like a big ball of joy. Uh-huh. But yeah, the this was back before, this was years and years ago, but Vice did a like 45 minute documentary on him when he was first like kind of coming on the scene.
Okay.
And he tells the story about how he started taking, you know, they weren't cold showers. They were, you know, he was submerging himself in cold water and then, you know, kind of tapping into this wisdom that I'm convinced he's remembered from a past life. But it was all rooted, or it started because he was suffering from depression because his wife passed away.
That's right. That's right. I remember hearing that part of the story. And if I'm not mistaken, a lot of his early practices, he was doing outside, right? He was doing a lot of this like cold water plunging out in like Arctic areas and like in these very snow-ridden areas.
I think he's from the Netherlands.
Okay.
So, I mean, it's extremely cold during the winter where he lives. And now he takes people on adventures where he teaches them the breath techniques, which are similar to a lot of like Kundalini pranayamas. Mm-hmm. And he teaches them, you know, the techniques and how to start to train your nervous system, like we've been talking about,
right.
Increasing your heart rate variability, your vagal nerve tone. And then he'll take people out into the wilderness in the wintertime, and they'll go up into like Austria in, you know, hiking boots and shorts, bare chested, no hat, no gloves, no anything. And because they're practicing the breath that he's taught them, they summit the mountain and come back, and they're like in freezing temperatures and they're fine.
That's amazing. That's so amazing. And I think that adds to another part of this is nature, like getting out in nature when you're feeling anxious and depressed.
Huge.
I mean, that's one of the biggest things for me. Is, you know, the literal grounding, taking my shoes off, go outside, stand in my yard and just like ground myself there. But taking a walk, going, you know, I mean, we're blessed in the Northwest with tons of trails, tons of mountains all over the place. Like I don't have to, like it's a stone's throw away that I can get anywhere I want and be away from people. I can like take out my headphones, have my dog on a walk and just reconnect with nature. And there is an immediate uprising of my energies. And just being connected again, like going up and touching a tree and maybe being the only person that's touched that tree in the past 5 years and saying hi to it and connecting with that tree or feeling the breeze blow against my face. Like there's so much that nature does to naturally raise our vibrations back up there.
100%. Yeah, there's scientific studies that just listening to sounds of nature, whether they're like, you know, in a recording, but I mean, nothing takes the place of doing it in person and live and for real, but it lowers stress levels.
Wow.
Listening to ocean waves or the wind blowing through the trees or birds chirping or a river, you know, the sound of a river, they all have positive effects to the nervous system.
Yeah. When I do my sound baths, generally they're about an hour long, and you know, I have a ton of different instruments from crystal bowls, Tibetan bowls, chimes, like all kinds of stuff, percussive instruments, all this stuff. But the one instrument that I constantly get feedback on, at least from one person every single sound bath, is I have a wave drum, an ocean drum. And
yes, I love that thing.
It's the most beautiful thing. And I generally bring it out about halfway through my sound bath. It, you know, let everything lie, let it be quiet for a little while. And the way I think about the wave drum is kind of like an eraser to a big, like, a dry erase board, right? You know, like the first half of the ceremony, all the energies are coming at me and I'm trying to figure out what's going on. I'm trying to like play bulls to get back at y'all, but everything's basically in my head going up on this whiteboard. And then when I come through halfway through with the wave drum, it's like a big eraser that just erases all of that energy and we start a brand new. And I, like I said, every time at least one person will be like, what in the hell was that noise that sounded like an ocean wave? That was the most beautiful thing. And, you know, a lot of people we're made 80% of water. A lot of us have some kind of nostalgia tied around the ocean, but it's those nature sounds that bring us back into our constitution and bring us back into that personal being that we know that we are, that we're connected to nature. We are nature. We're not separate from, you know, actually the definition of nature in the Webster's Dictionary, paraphrasing, basically says that anything that man is not a part of, right? So it's basically in the Webster's Dictionary, it's separating humans from nature. As you know, as a defining thing. And that's like, we are so not that. We are nature. We you know, we manifested from single cells. We were apes for a long time. We've grown into these, you know, bipedal, you know, animals that have this, you know, functioning language that can build shit with our hands, but we're still fucking animals. Like, you know, we're still part of nature. So when we separate ourselves from it, we're creating that divide and we're deepening that divide. So getting back into nature, go walking outside with your dog, go up, just take your shoes outside, walk outside. You know, it doesn't have to be anywhere like super remote, but just get re in touch with nature in some kind of way.
Yeah. We need also vitamin D. Mm. I mean, you have to get vitamin D from the sun. You absorb it from sunlight.
Yeah.
So allowing in the early morning or late afternoon, not when the sun is really bright, but in those early mornings or late afternoons or evenings, allowing direct sunlight to come into your eyes is also can be rebalances the effect, the levels of your cortisol and another hormone that affect your sleep patterns. Mm. So if you're someone who's suffering from insomnia, it could be that your cortisol levels are off, cortisol and this other hormone, and allowing that direct sunlight to come into your eyes can help balance it out.
Mm. I heard another similar kind of idea to that with vitamin D, and this is, I'll try not to derail the conversation too much, and this is a very esoteric comment, and I haven't personally tried it yet, but I've read a bunch of articles about it now, which is kind of funny, and it might just be like this new buzz thing in the spiritual community, but in the idea that vitamin D is, you know, we're all deficient in vitamin D in some kind of way, especially up in the Northwest where it's, you know, rainy and cloudy for most of the year, one of the practices now is sunning your anus to for about 30 seconds a day, because in theory, your anus is the least sun oriented part of your body. And so it has the most ability to absorb sunlight in a really quick way. So the idea is you basically take a happy baby pose, which if you're a yogi, you know what I'm talking about. If not, you're laying on your back and your knees are open wide and you're naked, and you basically shine your butthole up to the sun for about 30 seconds and allow that vitamin D to enter into your body from your butthole.
Oh my God.
And I've tried not to derail the conversation too much, but it's such a comedic thing for me to think about, especially, you know, where I live here. I have neighbors surrounding me all over the place. So if I ever wanted to try this, I'd really have to make sure I'm in a safe place. But you know, the science and the idea behind it makes sense. You know, we're bringing in vitamin D into a part of our body that doesn't get it. And we're all vitamin D deficient, but you know, it's just a little,
there's lots of nerve endings there. Right. I know that much.
Right. All right. So bringing it back. So one of the things you talked about too was ambiguous loss. And yeah, that was a term that I hadn't really heard until you brought it up. And, you know, doing research into that, you know, it makes a lot of sense. But do you mind sharing what you can about ambiguous loss?
Yeah, it's something that was one of the COVID stress factors. So we've talked about isolation. We've kind of mentioned fear of infection. Mm-hmm. What we actually didn't talk about were the death, the grief, and the death of loved ones, financial concerns. A lot of people, you know, lost their jobs, or, you know, their salaries were decreased or whatever. But one of the other major ones was something called ambiguous loss. So I heard a group of psychologists talking about this on a podcast that I was listening to. And it's a term that hasn't been around for very long, but it's this idea of, especially in the pandemic, we suddenly had this like long list of little things that we always appreciated. Maybe some of us didn't, you know, have our gratitude journal and always acknowledge that we appreciated, you know, going to the corner cafe and seeing our favorite barista and running into a neighborhood neighbor, mm-hmm. And just saying hi, you know, a couple times a week. The ability to go for a run or go on your favorite hike, the, you know, ability to swing by your mom's house and give her a hug and ask her for a recipe. Just all these like little tiny things that suddenly we were no longer allowed to do, that were like our, you know, we took them for granted in many ways, that they were like these daily activities that, that just brought us like little joys throughout our day. And when you combine the loss of all of those together at once because of isolation, it becomes ambiguous loss. And so that's what these psychologists were saying. One of the reasons why so many people were suffering from such intense like sadness was, but they couldn't quite put their finger on it.
Right.
You know? I found it extremely interesting, and also it had so much value. Like, we couldn't travel, like, for those of us that really love to travel. And I identify as someone who's like an explorer. You know, I lived in Los Angeles for 11 years, and I would sometimes just go, where does this street go? Like, I've never turned out, you know, and I would just drive down the street just to see where it went.
Oh yeah.
And then, you know, suddenly you can't even leave your house. Let alone go explore something new. You know?
Yeah.
So yeah, all of those things were really contributing to the sadness that people were feeling.
Right. And you know, that ambiguous loss is going to be different for every single person, because we all have those little things that we counted on that we didn't realize we counted on. You know, I luckily, you know, I love my spouse and we get along very great, and we have a house with a backyard. So, you know, a lot of the time during COVID isolation, we had, you know, a loving, supporting group, and we were able to, you know, go outside if we needed to. But, you know, I have a friend that lives in France, and they couldn't even like open their windows, couldn't go outside on the street with it unless they had like a special slip of some sort.
Yeah.
So going to the grocery store, there was only specific times and specific days that specific people could go, and like all these little things that, you know, you don't, like you said, you don't realize what you're missing out on in the world until all of it gets together and all of it becomes this big thing of like, holy shit, like I don't realize why I'm so upset, but I'm fucking upset right now. You know, all these things that we're not able to experience in life that we used to just, you know, just be able to do whatever the hell we wanted to.
Yeah.
And it's interesting now that, kind of, I don't know how it is down in Mexico, but up here now, and it's a little different now because the restrictions have been lifted for a little while now. But in that very beginning, when those restrictions started getting lifted, it's almost like people were fighting for those ambiguous losses to stay lost again. You know, people didn't want to go out. They didn't want to go and take that chance. They didn't want to go to their kids' graduation. They were against graduations because it's a group gathering and all these things, because there was so much fear still involved with the misinformation that we were getting from all the different directions. You know, not trying to blame anybody, but there was so much misinformation that was going around that we didn't know what to believe. So it kind of like threw people into this hermit kind of state, and it justified it for a lot of people. And that's really dangerous because, you know, like we were talking about, we need community. We need to be around people. And not only that, we need to be around people that have differing opinions than us. We need not to be around those people that just support the kookiness that we embrace. I need people around me that are going to disagree with me, that are going to share different opinions, that take me out of my own personal thought process. And so, you know, that's another of that level of that anxiety and depression that we can maybe, you know, touch on, is that when we were able to finally communicate and get into these groups, we were finding these echo chambers of all of the shared anxiety and depression, which kind of kept us in that area because we were surrounded by the fear of the misinformation that was going on there.
Yeah.
It's like we're perpetuating our own demise without even really realizing it, you know. But, you know, kind of to your point earlier, we take a step back, we take a deep breath, we listen to our bodies, we listen to our constitutions, and we can start to understand, like, no, that's my irrational brain that's talking right now. That's not the way that I want to think. That's not the way I'm traditionally thinking. Let's try to get back into a place where I'm conscious of the thought and I'm proud of the way that I show up in this world, and we can get through this together.
Yeah, there's lots of different teachers who speak about that in different ways. Kundalini talks about, you know, the negative mind, which is not negative. We need the negative mind. It helps us. It keeps us safe. Right. But it can become overactive, where suddenly everything, we're being completely irrational, and then nothing is safe and no one is safe.
Right.
You know, I know Byron Katie has a whole process that she talks about in her book, The Work, where you can ask yourself, well, is that really true? Is that really true? You know, or NLP would discuss it, would refer to it as like your unconscious mind, because the prime directive of your unconscious mind is to protect and preserve the body, the physical body. And so it will do anything to do that. And that even means creating limiting beliefs based on something that happened decades ago.
Right.
In an attempt to not allow that to happen again. But are we reacting from some, you know, a fear of that happening again, or are we responding appropriately to something that's actually happening in this present moment?
Right. And that's, yeah, I think that's where a lot of that anxiety comes from, is that we're so worried about what might happen, that we're planning for that thing that could potentially happen, that has maybe no track record of ever happening, but definitely it's a possibility of happening. But now that one thought has just gripped your entire existence, and everything is cautionary around that one thought now of potentially happening, right? Being a parent, like, that was one of the hardest things for me to understand as a parent, is that, like, your kids are going to get out there. They're going to fuck some shit up, right? They're going to get in situations that they'll have to get themselves out of. They're going to get into conversations, arguments, all these things that I have no control over. So for me to just, like, keep my child inside bubble wrapped in their room is not going to do any good for that child. That child's got to live and learn and understand what's going on with humanity. So they've got to get out there and experience life. And I got to remind myself that too, when I get, because I've, you know, what I would consider social anxiety, a lot of it I think is spurred from working in hospitality industry for so long. I've seen fights break out for no reason. I've seen, you know, brawls. I've seen all kinds of crazy shit that's happened in restaurants, nightclubs, all the places that I've worked at, that, you know, there's a little bit of that in me, but also at the same time, my rational brain knows that I'm in my house right now. A fight's not going to break out. It's me and my dog. Right? I'm fine. Why do I still think and prepare in cautionary just in case these things do happen? Anything can fucking happen, right? I'd rather, you know, where I'm trying to come at this now is how present can I be in this moment and be with the person that's across from me and not plan about what's going to happen next and not worry about what just happened, but just be here in this exact present moment with the person or with the embracement of everybody and everything that's around me.
Yeah. Well, you bring up a really good point about that and anxiety, because anxiety is always a concern about the future.
Right.
Always. We're never anxious about the past.
Right.
Because it already happened. We already know the outcome. So there's actually a technique that sometimes we help people with that are suffering from anxiety to identify exactly what is the thing that they're concerned about, and then imagine 10 minutes forward of that, even further into the future. Mm-hmm. Of, like, let's take the example of, like, somebody that is having anxiety because there's turbulence on an airplane. Mm. So, okay, let's identify what would be the safe end to this turbulence, and the safe ending would be being on the ground safely, like landing on the ground safely. That would be the end to the concern. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, consider 10 minutes forward of that. What might you be doing? Okay, well, I'm in the terminal. I've exited the plane. I'm now in the terminal. I've gone to the restroom, and now I'm walking on my way to baggage claim to, you know, go meet my loved one. Mm-hmm. And we just have them focus on that instead of the turbulence.
Right, right. And we all love stories. Humans love stories. We've been telling stories since our existence started. You know, and it sounds like what you're doing is just changing the story in their head. Instead of this, like, oh my God, what could happen? It's like, oh, right now I'm sitting at a coffee shop enjoying a Frappuccino and talking with a friend. This is great. Screw this turbulence crap.
Yeah. Yeah. And so the irony is anxiety is a lot about the future. Mm-hmm. And one of the symptoms of depression, sometimes for some people, can be guilt. And that it's the opposite with guilt. Guilt is always about the past.
Ah, yes. Yeah.
It's about something we can't go back and change. Mm-hmm. And I kind of try to lighten the mood and joke and say, we never feel guilty for the chocolate cake we haven't yet eaten. Right?
Damn straight.
We don't feel guilty for the thing we haven't, the mean thing that we haven't said to somebody yet.
Right. Yep.
Right? And so it's like being able to come to terms with exactly what you were saying, like being in the present moment now, and then now, and then now. And that's not to say that like we can't create action steps to plan for our future and have goals or intentions and, you know, things like that. Of course we can, and we should, if we want to, like, we have big lofty things that we want to achieve, like writing a book,
right?
And things like that. But the only thing we can focus on is this present moment.
Damn straight. Couldn't have said it better myself. One of my favorite things right now, I learned from Alan Watts, who was a, you know, very spiritual speaker. I think he passed away in the 70s, but, and he said, paraphrasing, but he said basically, you know, stop trying to judge your day on how productive you are and start looking at your day and how present are you through your productivity. And that statement changed my life. You know, I'm very list oriented. I have a list every single day. I try to knock out that list, but the flip side of that is, as organized as that seems, I beat myself up for not finishing that list. And I could have 30 things on that list and get 25 of them done. And those 5 things that I didn't do, I will just incessantly beat myself up about. And there's no reason for that shit. There's no reason that I need to make that a priority, that I need to get all that stuff done. Right. But that's all in my head. That's all a story that I've created in myself, that I'm not enough because I didn't do all that shit. What I've switched to now is I could have 5 things on that list. If I get one done with the presence of mind that I feel that I needed to, and it could be, you know, like replacing the light cover switch on my daughter's room. And every time I move that screwdriver to the right to tighten that screw, I'm thinking about how safe my daughter's going to be when she turns on her light next time, and how much light's going to be in that room, and how joyous she can now color, she can paint, she can play with her damn toys, do all the things that she can because she has a safe light switch. And that might seem exhausting, but it brings me so much peace of mind now to just be in the present moment for this thing. Like right before our interview started, I was sitting out there with my dog face to face, and I was looking at her in the eyes and cuddling her and just appreciating her for the being that she is. You know, and my cat came over and wanted some attention too, and I'm like, no, not right now. I'm here with the dog, right? And I'm here right with Olive. And it's that those moments of pause, of connection, of presence that we have the ability to have constantly through the day. And in my opinion, I think if we take more advantage of those moments and really dial in and lean into those presence, the presence of your moment right now, I think that will show us the happiness we truly have and not the sadness that we feel that we've created the story around.
Amen.
Amen. Well, Heather,
aho,
girl, aho. Well, Heather, I'm deeply grateful for our conversations always. I know I've taken up a bit of your time today. Do you have any final parting thoughts you want to talk about with this sensitive subject we've been discussing for the last hour and a half?
I guess the last thing that I would want to say is, like, if you are questioning or thinking that you may be, you know, suffering from symptoms of anxiety and or depression, you're not alone. Think of someone in your life who you feel safe with and talk to them about it, or talk to a professional. But you're not alone. There's 1 in 3 at least Americans suffering right now.
Yeah.
And the more that we can, like I said before, like destigmatize this and make it an active conversation, something that we're willing to address, the more that together we can heal.
Amen to that. Create the vulnerability, have the conversations. You know, you'd be surprised that the person that's holding the space for you might be sharing a very similar situation, and your courage can help them find their courage.
Yeah. And it's worth saying that feeling that safety in your physical body, like really dropping in a quiet moment and saying, like, who do I really feel like I could talk to this about? Who, like, when I'm with this person, what does it feel like in your physical body? when you're with that person. Hmm. And find the safest person.
Beautiful. Well, thank you so much, Heather. I'm deeply grateful for you.
Thank you.
Conversation. Thank you for your vulnerability and all of your advice and all of your beautiful work that you do. Very looking forward to having you come back on, maybe with a lighter subject next time, you know, but I love your information. I love the way you deliver it. It's fantastic. And I really appreciate you.
Yeah. I hope that your listeners also consider me a resource as well.
Most definitely.
They can also reach out to me. I work with people virtually as well. So Yeah.
And we'll leave all of Heather's contact info and the previous podcast she was on and all the show notes and everything for us. So you can get in touch with her if you need it.
Thank you, Adam. Thank you for the work you do. Have a good night.
Thank you so much for joining Heather and I today. Check out the show notes for any links and ways to get in touch with Heather through her website or through her email, as well as the previous episode that Heather was on, episode number 63, where we talk about her neurolinguistic programming and Kundalini yoga backgrounds. Remember, if you need help, if you have suicidal thoughts, please reach out. There are hotlines out there that can help. There are friends that you can talk with, but there is a way to find help. Please exercise those ways. Find the help you need. We'll see you next time.